Happy birthday to you.
Creepy.
Happy birthday to you.
Still creepy.
Happy birthday, Mrs. President. Happy birthday to you.
Great job.
Happy birthday, Lizzie.
Thank you. Super creepy, but I appreciate it. And so do our listeners.
If they stuck through that, then it can only go uphill from here. We are the House of Pod. We're a medical type podcast. Talk about medical type things, usually, sometimes not. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. Happy birthday. Thank you. It's been a good day. It's beautiful here. Went to the beach, saw some Kaveh, got a little Kaveh time.
That's right.
Sent a lot of our listeners stickers over the weekend. So everyone, we hope you enjoy. Please check your mail. Just in like doing some hikes and being outside, I was listening to the radio a lot. And there's a story from Freakonomics, which I don't listen to that often. But I heard this story, essentially how car seats are not any better than seatbelts.
You mean our kids, like kids' car seats?
Sorry. Yeah. I didn't know that there was adult car seats.
No, I mean, like car seats, I imply like, you know, the seats that you sit in a car.
No, sorry. The child, car seats. Yeah. Okay, yeah. For children. I think it's above, if it's above the age of two. So infants, you know, you can't sit and get a seatbelt on them, you know, if they're 1 year old or a few months old, but 2 years old and above, and maybe to 11 or whatever the terms are now, like, I think you're supposed to have a kid in a car seat until they're 40 pounds or something like that.
Yeah.
But that apparently there's actually no data that's ever said a car seat for a 3, 4, 5, 6 year old is better than just an adult seatbelt.
No kidding.
And yet our transportation, Secretary of Transportation and our Department of Transportation makes it a law that you have to use a car seat, which I found fascinating for so many reasons. And you know how everyone talks about big pharma. I'm like, oh my God, big car seats are totally ruining the industry of, you know, free driving. Because as you know, as a parent, car seats are a huge pain in the ass and very challenging for some people. And apparently the technology hasn't really changed or improved over the last 10 or 20 years. But I just thought that was so interesting because the argument is that people are essentially having fewer kids. People are not having that third kid. And one tiny part of that is because the obstacle of car seats and transportation is such a huge burden that people might not have that third kid. That's, I thought the whole thing was fascinating.
I have to say, I am surprised that there's no evidence. Because I hear from lots of parents that are like, particularly mothers, who are like, I'm keeping my kid in a car seat for as long as possible. And it's interesting to know that. I did not know that. I would love to see if anyone else has any evidence to the contrary. We'd love to see it.
Yeah.
But that these is guys very
did
interesting.
Their, so, they did their own experiments. They did their own crash test dummy experiments. And apparently they had a really hard time finding a crash test site that would let them do the experiment. I think because they were scared of big car seat.
Wait, so you're implying that because of this like car seat lobby, that's why we have these rules, because there's no evidence behind it, but the car seat has somehow put pressure on our Secretary of Transportation.
Yeah, for two reasons. I think the business is huge. So yeah, you're saying the pro car seat lobby, if that's a thing, who knows? We have no idea what we're talking about. But the second thing is because it's intuitive and it makes sense. So I think people just buy it. Literally and figuratively. Wow. People just buy into it and they are happy to go buy it. If you think that you are saving your kid and helping reduce risk, you're going to buy it. It's a total.
Totally.
You know, the industry is a mind game, right?
Well, if we suddenly disappear and there's no more recordings of the House of Pod, it's because of big car seat that got to us.
Anyway, it's not important. I my mind was blown. I just thought I wanted to share that.
All right. Well, if you want to hear more stuff that's going to blow your mind, Lizzie, stay tuned because we have a really interesting guest coming up. We have Trisha Pendergrast. She is a medical student and she's written a paper recently about online harassment of doctors. It's a really interesting article. I want to go over it with her and also talk to her just about medical school in general. I got a lot of questions about that. Before we go, shout out to Nadim. Thank you so much for helping us with production. A shout out to the good folks at Dropbox for helping us with providing the information storage space that we need to help do our show. And follow us on Twitter if you haven't, at the House of Pod, also on Facebook and Instagram as well. Anyone else you want to thank?
No.
Stay tuned. Welcome back. Today with us, we have Trisha Pendergrass. Pendergrass? Not Prendergrass, but Pendergrass.
No, first time. You nailed it on the first time.
Fantastic.
Yep.
And she is a second-year medical student from Northwestern Medical School. She has written a very interesting article in JAMA Internal Medicine that we want to talk to her about. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you. Will you tell our listeners a little bit about your background? So you're a second year med student, and a little bit about your class of 164 people.
Yeah. So I'm a second year at Northwestern University, Feinberg School of Medicine right now. We're in that weird time where we're kind of studying for step and also going to school full time of the year. And it's been a very unique experience thus far because I've had my entire M2 year and part of my M1 year has been completely remote because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting time to come into medicine. Have you been seeing patients?
So for the last several months, we have been. We're one of the schools that does a longitudinal clinical experience, which is something that's pretty popular with the medical schools these days. You either get a preceptor at the beginning of your M1 year and stick with them for all four of your years, or you get put into they're called education-centered medical homes, but it's me and current M1s and M3s and M4s and a doctor, and we're there the whole time, M1 through M4 year, and I go every other Tuesday. So I see patients, but it's for an afternoon every other week. So it's not like I'm on clerkships. We were pulled from that for a little bit in the beginning of the pandemic, but I've been doing that this year, M2 year.
So during COVID, I spent a little time at Bellevue in April. And at that time they had just graduated all of the fourth year med students because it was March and April when it really struck New York City. They were all going to graduate in 2-3 months anyway. And I don't know if you know yet, but the fourth year med school is a little bit of a joke for some people, right? So they're like
your best year.
Yeah. It's like a lot of people focus on their research or do the things that they're interested in doing. So it should be lighter, a little bit lighter. So they graduated all those med students and they went to help and be like interns and run around the hospital and take care of dying patients and call family members and all the things that we've seen on every newspaper and every news outlet. Have you had to be redeployed in any way during COVID?
No, I'm not useful enough yet.
Yeah, it's true.
The gist of it. No, I mean, I haven't been redeployed in that way. We were not in a situation in Chicago where that became necessary. I found other things. These are boxes of PPE behind me. So I found other things to do to occupy myself pandemic-wise and still help. And many of my classmates have as well. But we were never put into clinical situations to do, intern work.
Yeah. So what are you doing with those giant boxes of PPE that I see behind you?
Besides stacking them so nicely.
Yeah. Nice Jenga.
Thank you. So I'm one of the co-founders of an organization called Get Me PPE Chicago. We do PPE distribution to community organizations and healthcare workers. And we've been at that since my spring break last year. That was why I was like, this is fine. It'll just last to the end of the week. And we're still at it, 10 months later. So.
Well, that's great, man.
You mean right at the beginning of COVID? That's like spring break is like usually March-ish, right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So we're like, let's just reclaim this PPE and get it to where it needs to go. And then, I guess we're approaching a year later and there's still PPE shortages.
So the silver lining of that story, you could say that you've had the longest spring break in history. So congratulations. It sounds like you won the jackpot, right?
Yes. Indoors. Just in my kidding. Apartment.
It's terrible. No, thank you for helping. It sounds
thank you
like
so
a
much.
Great.
You're doing a lot. So you had mentioned in passing before the step that you were in the midst of or the step that you were preparing for. Can you tell our listeners, some of them who don't know about the step, what is the step and which one are you on?
The worst one.
Which is
step one.
Mm-hmm.
So I have myself and the other M2s right now have the distinct pleasure of being the last class to take step one, which is our board examination for a 3-digit score. So this is a test that was designed to essentially assess our knowledge of the things that we learned in the preclinical years and has been, for lack of a better term, weaponized. And now controls essentially whether you match into a residency and which residency you match into.
It's really amazing to us because we had an episode with Salman Khan, the Khan Academy guy, and we were talking about this and we were trying to explain to him that, you know, when we took step one, it wasn't the same thing that it is now. Now it's like one of the steps are like the major sources of like medical student like stress and anxiety and depression. It's like a real threat to medical students now because it's so intense now. And now it's going to be going pass fail. I assume you think that's a good idea from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, about this time yesterday, I was in tears because I was so overwhelmed at the prospect of continuing to study 4-step and also having to pass my school. It's just so much information and it's not information that's always clinically relevant. And I think that's what the most frustrating part has been me sitting at my computer for the last couple weeks as I'm trying to cram in step studying for an exam that I don't take until April, while taking time away from doing lectures where I could be learning from, you know, content experts, really interesting things. I mean, we're in the reproductive module and this is stuff that's very, you know, interesting to me. I've always been passionate about reproductive healthcare and I have to take time away from that to learn about how purines and pyrimidines are synthesized in the cell in every way that it can go wrong.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what do you mean? Can you elaborate a little bit about weaponized? You're saying that ultimately it carries so much weight that it becomes like the thing that makes or break a student?
Yeah, it's not hyperbole to say that the score that you get on STEP can render everything that you've done up until that point irrelevant. Yeah. So if you blow it on STEP, and you don't get the score that you want, you could have wanted to be a dermatologist your entire career. Yeah. Since you were in high school, you got really passionate about dermatology, you shadowed, you got into a great med school, and then you just had a bad day on STEP, or you really mm-hmm. struggled to study for standardized exams, and you pass, but you don't do well enough.
Yeah.
End of dream.
Yeah. That's terrible. Kaveh and I actually had different experiences and we did talk about this. That for us, we all took studying for that month like a job. We were all in the library 8 a.m. to like 4 or 5 p.m. every day studying for step one. For us, it was incredibly intense, but we had that month off. We had already finished our coursework. So right. We were actually had the time to go crazy about it. And we all just spent about a month. Oh, you do? Okay.
So our dedicated starts in March.
Okay.
That 6 weeks isn't enough though.
Okay. Yeah.
There are people who have been studying since like September of last year.
Yeah. But I think what you're saying is the weight of it for us doesn't sound anything like the way that you're describing.
No. Our weight was, for sure. It didn't matter that much to us. I mean, I had a very different experience. We like put a couple weekends into that. I did not stress about that test. And our book was so different. Like, it's so funny because we have this USMLE book that prepares you for it. And ours is a thin little book. And show us your book.
Oh yeah. You can see, if you line all the first aids up, you can Google them online. This is the 2019 version.
No.
That's like four steps, of the
and there were only had. It was four and there were only 3 steps to take and that's the size of 4 steps. That's terrible.
It's pretty bad. So I feel for you. I feel for you. You're gonna do great though, Trisha. You're gonna do great. I can tell.
It's going pass fail though, which is so important because you touched on it at the beginning. This is, without a doubt, one of the greatest drivers of anxiety and depression and suicidality in medical students. And to culminate your preclinical time with that, and then have to turn around and go into the clinical years and to head onto the wards. It's just so unhealthy what we're going through right now.
Yeah.
And more important, it's unhealthy and sounds traumatizing, but the worst part of it all is that it almost sounds irrelevant. Like, it's not making you a better doctor is what you're saying. And that's a terrible way to learn. You know, I think Solomon Kahn would agree. Like, it's just a terrible culture and with poor outcomes.
I agree with that completely. I will say this though, and I don't know if this makes it any better, but I still remember like some of the pictures from like that book when I was studying. I still remember bits of that from the study. So it's not going to leave you completely. It's not the kind of thing that you study for and then as soon as you're done, it's going to leave your brain completely.
No. You'll hold on to it. You'll just never need it.
Yeah.
I think there's like two different things that are happening. One is that it's an excellent way to consolidate your last couple of years. And in that way, it's super important. Like right. I feel myself getting smarter in interpreting vague clinical things.
Right.
But the problem is that it also rewards knowledge of asinine facts that no one ever needs. So if we could have the consolidation, and this is what pass-fail does, if we could have the consolidation without having to push ourselves to know everything, when we don't totally understand those asinine facts but are able to consolidate, we still get the benefits that Lizzie is talking about with what you're talking about, which is the consolidation.
Right? Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, every residency program needs to have a bar that they felt is met. And I don't think it matters that much, the point differential. And that's clearly some of the guys I knew and people I knew in medical school that got the best scores on stuff did not seem to be the best clinical doctor. So I don't know. Anyways, well, good luck with that.
That sounds terrible. I like that at least you feel yourself getting smarter, because today on my birthday, I feel myself getting dumber.
You are every year and older.
I know this happens.
Yeah, it does. 100%.
So let's shift gears a little bit and let's talk about this article that you wrote. It's called Personal Attacks and Sexual Harassment of Physicians on Social Media. It's on JAMA Online ahead of publication, and it's going to be in JAMA Internal Medicine. It's really interesting. I think it's really interesting to talk about it now, in particular, because I think things have shifted a little bit during COVID. But can you give us the rundown on your paper? Give us the sort of the conclusion statement on your paper, what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a survey study of physicians that were recruited on social media. So it was a study about social media, recruited on social media. And we surveyed these physicians and asked them yes or no to two questions. Have you ever been personally targeted or attacked on social media? And have you ever been sexually harassed on social media? And then we gave a free response box that was optional to allow people to elaborate on either of those points if they so desired. So we found that women were more likely than men to report being harassed online. And we found that about 1 in 4, 23.3%, I believe, reported being personally attacked on social media, and a total of 1 in 6 female physicians reported being sexually harassed, which is consistent with wherever you look, whether it's in person and online and academia, outside of it, that women are more frequently sexually harassed.
At the similar rates, like around 1 in 4, 1 in 6, are those rates correlate?
Consistently that women are always harassed more.
Right. Yeah. And
what was there sort of, did you have a bar that had to be met to meet the criteria of harassment? You know, not just someone saying something mean to them in passing in Twitter, but it has to be something more targeted, right? Was there a criteria that had to be met?
It was honestly just based on whatever, it was a yes or no question. So it was whatever they thought was harassment or personal attacks. And I think that design is important, because what I consider harassment may not be what you consider harassment, but I think it's important to recognize that really that experience is from the perspective of the person being attacked. And so I don't know how much it would have benefited us to try and like parse through who.
It would be so hard to. I don't know how you would really, I guess.
Yeah.
But in the stories that they then would describe, what were people describing?
I was going to say, are you part of the people who are like reading the free text comments? Because that I think would be super enlightening and interesting and really and hard, I think, and probably yeah. incredibly sad.
Yeah, I did help with the categorization. We essentially put the types of attacks in buckets. So we tried to categorize them based on common themes. And really, the common themes that we found were either people were attacked based on advocacy. So there are topics that affect the way that physicians practice medicine and also affect the people that we provide care to, like vaccines and firearm injury prevention and smoking and access to women's health care, that some would consider controversial and others, myself, consider just essential public health communication. Right. There's personal attacks that we found that people were, targgeted based on their race. There was threats of lynching. People were sent images of the Holocaust because they publicly identified as Jewish. And then there were these work-based attacks, which are like these coordinated either doxing where personal information was published online, NPI information was published online, wow. or facilities were called. So there would like be coordinated calling attacks on clinics where people would call and harass the clinic where a physician worked.
Okay, I got a couple of questions. One, was there any evidence of where these were coming from? Like how many of these were coming from the general public, these attacks, and how many were coming from other people in medicine?
Great question. We did not record that information. I wish we did.
Survey studies are so hard. I mean, right. you have to design it like you're doing yes and no, zeros and ones. It's the easiest and only way to really analyze this stuff. And even to categorize must have been so difficult. Like it sounds like after the fact, post hoc analysis, whatever, you tried to categorize it into groups, workplace, mm-hmm. like you said, or, kind of advocacy. But when you think about it, especially in this culture today, when you think about implicit bias and microaggressions, like those are hard to pull out, it's yeah. hard to put those in a right. category. And for a lot of people, especially living in white privilege, it's hard to even identify that it's harassment unless you are actually trained in that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, which brings us back to the original point where it was so important that it was the person who was getting harassed that was telling right. us they were being harassed. And we can just say, that person said yes, as opposed to me trying to interpret someone
right.
else's experience.
Sure, right. The point I was making about, medical, whether it was coming from a medical source or not, because, mm-hmm. Med Twitter and the world online, the medical world online, there's a lot of difference of opinion there. It's not a homogeneous group. And there's a lot of conflict within that group. Mm-hmm. Trisha's giving a knowing look right now. I'm sure she has a story or two. So that would really be interesting to me to see the people who are trying to dox. Like the people that seem sometimes the most interested in doing that aren't necessarily people from the outside world, people within. But one thing that was interesting about the study was it's correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like the biggest group, the biggest source came from vaccine-related harassment. Or I'm assuming that meant doctors wrote something about like, hey, get your vaccines. And somebody wrote something like, go to hell, you child murdering bastard. And I will say from our personal experience, we've done shows about abortion. We've done mm-hmm. shows about guns. We've done shows about anything that you might consider sort of questionable in any way. And the only time we've even done shows on Q. And the only time we get the most like hate mail, the most like anger, the most visceral reaction we ever got was when we talked about two things, vaccines and supplements. How supplements are not useful and how vaccines are super useful. And the shit we got is crazy. I mean, people, like when it comes to that sort of stuff, are fanatical in like a scary way.
It's a part of their identity. I mean, right. and this is I think this like leaves this like physician harassment specifically. And I think that people who are so ingrained in a school of thought will attack anyone who yeah. is in opposition to them. And I think at that point, it's not even the fact that you're a physician. It's just that you think that vaccines are helpful and it's yeah. like a part of their identity. So when you endorse vaccines, you go against who they are.
That group of people, they believe in it in a way that some of the other people don't. Like, for example, there's politicians out there who will say, you can't get abortions. You shouldn't get abortions. Oh, that's against God's law. But then they're like secretly trying to get their mistress an abortion somewhere.
Right.
Or there's people who will like come out and pretend they're super NRA friendly to get them to support them, but they don't really care that much. But if you're someone who really believes the vaccines are causing illness to your kids, you're willing to put your kids in harm's way.
Yeah.
If you're willing to do that, you are someone who is really dangerous.
So that's like the final straw, honestly, in a lot of ways. Like, people are willing to harm their children for the sake of it, right?
What time period, I don't recall from the study, over what time period were these surveys administered?
Was it the Victorian era? No, it was before COVID, unfortunately. I think that may be where you were going with that question.
That is where I was going. I'm not sure if you're still plugged into the study or if it's going to continue, or just from your experience doing the study, if you're like, kind of invested in it. Do you know for a fact, or would you guess that during COVID things have heightened, I guess, or worsened? I mean, we can all imagine based on what's been going on, but do you have any knowledge of it?
Yeah, it's a good question. So unfortunately, the data does not capture the coronavirus pandemic. We recruited for this study, I actually think it was a couple years. Yeah, in 2019. So all of our crystal balls were not functioning that day. And we don't have any data from the current time. However, 2-3 of the authors on the study are part of a group that does public health messaging around COVID and have been talking about their personal experiences being harassed based on being like saying totally fringe and unreasonable things like wear a mask, stay 6 feet apart, don't go outside if you don't need to, just really basic things. We as a group hypothesize that the rate of and viciousness of personal attacks on physicians has only increased during the pandemic.
No, it's there's no way it hasn't. People are so on edge, and I find triggers are everywhere where they weren't, and the triggers are much more, whatever the term is, someone help me with a gun term, much easier to release, if that's a term. Like, you talk about just at work, you say something like, please don't gather, don't have potlucks. And nurses on one side and doctors on another are like, you're accusing me of doing what? You know, like people just feel on edge and everyone feels like they're getting blamed. And if there's an outbreak, they're like, you're clearly blaming me. You know, when you're just saying, please wear a mask, please socially distance, please don't gather, people feel like it's personal, you know?
It's crazy. And then there's the other group of people who are so far, they've been denying that there's been danger this whole time and now can't go backwards.
Right.
So they only dig deeper into denying that there's no danger and just getting more entrenched in that.
Right. Yeah. And the amount of people who are still vaccine hesitant, and again, healthcare workers who are not getting vaccinated, I find just so disappointing, really. I'm just blown away at the numbers of people avoiding and not signing up when they could be in the front of the line.
That bothers me a lot too. I do think that those numbers are going to change significantly. I think there is a proportion of medical healthcare workers who are out there who just need to see it. God bless you. Who need to see it done a couple times, who just need to see the doctors doing it, need to see other nurses doing it. Those people will get it. And then I think they will, I think the numbers will rise for healthcare workers. I have faith in our community. I swear I do. Anyways, Tricia, we know you have to go study. You have a lot of work to do.
Sorry.
O'clock. After this, I'm going to go play Sims and then go to bed. So.
All right, right on. And a Star Wars t-shirt is on. You have clarified that you are a nerd. Yes. I have
a Star Wars tattoo.
Oh my God. She has the Rebel Alliance tattoo, folks. Yes. Pretty cool. Yep. I just have hair on my arm.
You know.
To each their own. So, Tricia, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time, and we're looking forward to seeing what you accomplish with the rest of your career. I think it's going to be pretty amazing, and I'm really looking forward to following along. So please come back on some point and let us know when you put out some more stuff. And if you ever do a follow-up on that study, if you have anything else going on, please let us know, okay?
Yeah, we're working on 2.0, so I will be in touch.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Tricia.
Okay. Oh, I love your Star of David sweater, I think.
Oh, can you see it? I was going to show it to you in the middle, and then I was like, that's not appropriate. Nobody needs to know that I'm wearing a unicorn sweater.
Oh my God, everyone needs to know you're wearing a unicorn shirt.
Yeah, unicorns.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employers. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible.